Welcome to the Power of the Purse podcast, the only show connecting women professionals to their peers. Join us in a vibrant conversation about the constant struggle to find balance between the demands of their careers and their relationships with money, family, and personal freedom. This isn't just about money. This is about life. Now, here's your host, Lynn S. Evans.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Lynn Evans, and I am interviewing today Dr. Vicki Rackner, MD, who is a physician who has made made many financial mistakes, and she now works full-time to help physicians build wealth. She had a career as a surgeon in private practice and had a clinical faculty appointment at the University of Washington School of Medicine. She is currently writing and working on a book called Myth of the Rich Doctor. Welcome, Dr. Rackner.
Well, thank you so much, Lynn. What a delight it is to speak with you.
I can't wait to get into this conversation because I am so excited about the premise of your book. And full disclosure to everyone listening, Dr. Vicki Rackner and I have been friends for years. The interesting thing is we've never physically met, but we've known each other for a long time, both of us on the same path of trying to educate physicians, especially women physicians, on the importance of knowing some kind of financial skills. We know that historically, women physicians have a higher rate of divorce relative to the general population, and much of this is one of the areas where they find they come full face into their lack of knowledge in personal finance. So I would love if you would start out by telling us a little bit about your background, Vicki, and how you got into what you got into. What motivated you to leave the world of medicine as a full-time surgeon and decide that you wanted to take on this passion, because it truly is a passion for you.
All right. So fasten your seatbelts, because this is a twisty ride. I'll try to make it as simple as possible. So I was a graduate student in my early 20s when one day I fainted on my way to the bathroom. I was rushed to the hospital where I was found to have a ruptured ovarian cyst that had ruptured over a blood vessel. And by the time I got to the operating room, about half of my blood volume was in my pelvis. So I really thought I was dying, and I woke up in the recovery room just knowing I was going to be a doctor, save other people's lives like my own had been saved, and not surprisingly, I became a surgeon. I had a private practice in Seattle and this clinical faculty appointment at the University of Washington School of Medicine, and I primarily treated women with breast cancer, and this was humbling and rewarding. I would have done this work for free. I could not believe my good fortune to have the privilege of doing this. So once things were kind of tucked in, I decided it was time to start my family. I had some fertility problems, and I was blessed to get pregnant through in vitro fertilization. I operated my whole pregnancy, and I had a plan. I was going to convert one of my exam rooms to a nursery and bring my son in, and my office manager was going to watch him while I was operating. Well, everything went just great. I had this beautiful son who was always just a little different. And when he got to be 9-10 months old and wasn't speaking, I pushed my pediatrician for an evaluation, and he was diagnosed with broad-spectrum developmental delay. Now, I want to remind you, I had been operating my whole pregnancy. I thought, what have I done to my son? He was in.
Oh, of course. It was guilt.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
We didn't know what was wrong with him, but I was sure that I was to blame. So he was enrolled in this special state-funded school, and he was my top priority. So I decided that I was going to take a leave from my practice and be a full-time mom. And boy, that was an educational experience, seeing health in a brand new way, because as a doctor, I thought of health as the absence of disease. And when somebody had disease like breast cancer, they were broken in some way. So how can a mother look at her child and see him as broken? So I had to redefine health. The bottom line is that he was retested after a year, and He has a wonderful brain that's just maturing on its own level. Lynn, he started at the University of Minnesota this year. He skipped his senior year of high school and just dove right in. So he's doing great. Yeah.
I didn't know that. That's wonderful.
Yeah. So it's such a delight to see him grow and flourish. But anyway, getting back to back then, you know, I had just spent a year away from my practice. I'd been making money by being an expert in medical malpractice lawsuits. And so there was this real question, like, what's my next step? And, you know, how many people have been a doctor, a patient, a family caregiver? How many people have seen the disaster stories in medicine? So in 2000, I decided that I was going to launch a consulting business, helping doctors and patients and family caregivers get the kinds of results that they wanted. And I kind of thought this was going to be a slam dunk. I mean, who doesn't want that? And that's when I discovered how I, as a physician, knew absolutely nothing about business. I also came to understand that I had a completely different relationship with money than business people do. Like, after all, everyone wants to win. Everyone wants to be successful. And a business person measures their business success by their profitability. And a doctor measures their level of success based on the people that they serve. How many people are they positively impacting? And, you know, if a business person were to talk about their profitability, you would say, wow, great doctor. But if a doctor were to talk about the profitability, you'd think, what kind of doctor is this in it for the money? So I spent a fair amount of time just going back and learning basic business skills, learning about money, about how to talk to money, learning about how I can exchange my value for money. And this was a long and slow learning process. And then 2008 rolls around, and I hear more and more of my physician colleagues telling some pretty desperate stories. And I thought I understood exactly why. It's because of this relationship with money. You know, a lot of doctors just don't want to talk about it. Money is dirty. You know, I don't want to pay attention to it, or I shouldn't be rich because, you know, I've taken a vow of service. And I saw doctors come unhinged. And like, I had some insight about why. It's because nobody teaches us about money. Nobody tells us how to make money grow. Nobody tells us that it's okay to build wealth or that we're worthy of wealth. And I think that women in particular suffer from money shame. You know, am I worthy of
wealth? Absolutely. And I think it's interesting you just mentioned that about, I know just by looking at some of what I've looked at in your book, The Myth of the Rich Doctor, that there are several physicians who are enormously wealthy. And then there are those who are pathetically poor. And there's got to be something that differentiates the rich ones from the poor ones. But I think even more so when you add on top of that what you just said about women physicians, that they need permission to be wealthy, to acquire wealth. That's a whole other dimension to it. So how do you deal with that?
Well, thanks for asking all those great questions. And I'm just gonna step back for a minute just to give us some functional definitions so that we're sort of all on the same page. Okay. And I define rich, after all, this is about the myth of the rich doctor. So I think somebody is rich if they can reliably meet their monthly expenses to fund their desired lifestyle.
Okay, that's a good definition.
And then the next question is, well, can you comfortably maintain your lifestyle when your earned income ends? Mm-hmm. And if the answer to that is yes, then you're wealthy. So I think women have a couple of different problems. The first problem is probably tied to worthiness and our cultural training. And it's that we don't make as much as men do. Even if you compare women who work full-time in medicine to men, women only make about 60% of what men do. And like, you wonder how and why is that possible? I remember reading Cheryl Sanders, what's her name? Sanderson? Cheryl Sandberg. Yeah, Lean In.
Yeah.
She was talking with Mark Zuckerberg about, you know, joining Facebook. And, you know, this is a seasoned executive. And Mark Zuckerberg made her an offer, and she was tempted to accept it. But then she went home and talked with her husband, and he said, no, no, don't accept that. That's the beginning of the conversation. You know, you need to go back to him and make a counter offer. And it occurred to me that if somebody of her stature, you know, somebody who would be invited to be in a leadership position at Facebook, a billion-dollar corporation, and she didn't know that, what about those of us who, you know, never learned about negotiating skills?
Yeah.
So that's part of the problem. I think another problem is that we simply want to serve if we're interested in our wealth or how much we're getting paid. I think that that casts us in the light of somebody who's just in it for the money. And no doctor wants to be thought of as somebody who's in it for the money, but we pay the price for that. I mean, literally and financially. And there's a strange thing, and maybe you can speak to it, Lynn, about this connection or disconnection between self-worth and net worth. Like, what's your experience been with that?
Well, there absolutely is a disconnect. There's no question about it. I think that women look at themselves first as the nurturers and the caregivers, and they think that the connection between doing that and getting paid really well to do that is a kind of a cultural taboo, because as mothers, we don't get paid to do those kinds of things. It's a gift we give to people because that's who we are. And then to muddy that up by putting it into a sphere of dollars and cents is somehow, it's just taboo. You just don't do that. So I think women, especially in the professions, I would say it's true of physicians as well as dentists, even lawyers and CPAs, women who are in those worlds of professions, they don't even think of themselves that way as being worthy of having more than what was initially offered to them. And I'm fascinated by a woman I know who is an attorney who works specifically to help women physicians negotiate contracts with employers. And she said exactly the same thing that Sheryl Sandberg's husband said, which is they initially make an offer, and the women will look at that and think, oh, that's pretty good, I'll take that. And then she takes a look at it. The key being it's a she. All right, she looks at that and says, no, that's exactly what her husband said. It's the first offer. Let's go back with a counteroffer. And that counteroffer is substantially greater than what she would have gotten, and plus other things, plus benefits, plus this, this, and this. They don't even think, women don't even think about those things. They don't even think they can justify asking for them. And so the end result is this woman does a phenomenal job of elevating the value of a woman physician beyond the first offer. And I agree with you that we're just not trained to think of ourselves that way.
Lynn, I hope you invite her on your podcast series. I would love to hear what
she has
to say.
I am. She's definitely one of my next guests.
Great.
Yes.
And if you think about it, like, let's say that you start out making $40,000 a year less than a man for doing the same job. I mean, over the course of a career, I mean, what's the difference in the ability to build wealth between the man and the woman? I mean, that could be millions of dollars, couldn't it, Lynn?
Absolutely. Absolutely, it could. And it's not just $40,000. It's $40,000 this year and then inflated at something else next year. And it's all that lost, those lost earnings contribute substantially to the net worth at 65 or 70 between men and women.
Mm-hmm.
So what are we going to do about this, Vicki?
Well, I think maybe somebody should do a podcast for women and bring this to their attention and perhaps give them some skills to do it. And, you know, I think the other thing we need to rethink, Lynn, is our relationship with money. Because I've spent a long time thinking about this. And it's not because I'm a money expert, but it's because in our society, money has such power and it has such meaning. And I think that if women understood that with greater wealth, they're able to serve in a bigger way, I think it would make wealth feel more accessible and more appropriate. And I'm coming to understand how that really is the truth.
Like how?
Well, let's say that you have been successful in building wealth and you are moved by infant mortality in a town in Africa that you visit. You have the resources to build a hospital. You know, you can make a difference in a lot of people's lives when you accumulate wealth.
That's for sure. You also mentioned some things in your book about times are changing. And you mentioned how a couple things, it's harder to do certain things. It's harder to make money. It's harder for your money to make money. And it's harder to know whom to trust to help you manage your money. Do you want to talk a little bit about those three things?
Well, you bet. So right now, I'm just talking about physicians and doctors. So the Affordable Care Act is a real game changer. You know, if you think about your health insurance premiums, they probably shot right up. And it's estimated that in order to insure, you know, all Americans, that bill is going to be $1.6 to $2.4 trillion. And how are we going to pay for that? How are we going to pay back our debt? You just sighed. What did you think about that?
What did I think about the number?
I heard a gasp from you.
Yeah, I did. Only because I think of that, and I just think of it relative to things like Social Security and all these other programs that we have in our society that no one thinks about. They just expect it to be there when they need it. So when you look at that number from the Affordable Care Act, and I know this is one of those things that everybody thought originally when it came out that it was supposed, well, I shouldn't say everybody thought. I think the Obama administration, when they were trying to sell it to the general public, were telling us that it was going to make things a lot better. All these people who were not insured in the past will now be insured. And so it was supposed to help. But nowhere in the conversation did I really hear a description of how are we going to pay for this. So I think that your point is that it's harder to make money. It's coming out of your pockets as well as it's coming out of the pockets of other people who can afford to pay premiums. So that does not bode well for physicians who are maybe in their 40s right now, who are expecting to have earned a certain amount of money. Then after they paid off their school loans, they might have a chance to build up some wealth themselves. It's getting much harder to do that under these circumstances.
It is getting much harder. So practicing physicians are facing, you know, rising costs of administration, because one of the ways that we're going to pay for the Affordable Care Act is through greater efficiencies, but really that falls on the shoulders of the doctors. The administration says that we're going to lower costs. And what that really means in a lot of cases is that the fees to physicians are going down. So here they are with rising costs and falling fees. And so they're kind of feeling the squeeze from both ends. In addition, as you mentioned, you know, more and more people are coming out of medical school with significant levels of debt. So it's really, really hard to, you know, have the earnings, and I'm not going to talk about how much should doctors make, but there's this financial expectation of what is reasonable to expect. And it's just not there anymore. But okay, so you're making less money, which means that you have less money to save and invest. But, you know, I talk with boomer physicians who were expecting their retirement income to be driven by, you know, robust returns on their investment in the market. And those are not there anymore either. So it's harder for your money to make money. And then, you know, who do you turn to for help? So Lynn, I have been in your world for a bunch of years. I've spoken at their meetings, and what is absolutely fascinating to me is to have conversations with smart people who say exactly the opposite things. And you're left wondering, what is the truth? Like, who do I believe?
Yeah, I know. And I would say to that, part of the problem is, and there's been some baby steps that have been made in the last year or so to help us get towards this. But there is no way to control the term financial planner. So anybody can hang out a shingle and say, I'm a financial planner. You can go from being a financial planner who opened your office yesterday to someone who is boasting here to say this, but I think it's true. Somebody who's been in the business for so many years that we've been through all the ups and downs and understand what it is that is something that is truly financial advice versus something that is really a very thinly disguised way of selling products. And both of those things, unfortunately, come under the title of financial planner. So how do you do that? It's really hard to distinguish it. But one of the ways I would say to people is, let's start with the designation of certified financial planner. At least that way you know that person has the educational experience and that they have to keep a certain amount of continuing education credits every year in order to keep that designation. That's helpful. That's the first place. But more importantly, I think you have to ask, how are people compensated? You know, it's one of those things that we go around and around on this, but with the new laws that just came out, fiduciary, which is an important word, versus something that would be considered to be appropriate based on your age or whatever, that's somebody else's valuation. There's something very distinctly different between those two. A fiduciary is someone who, by definition, has to take care of the, if you would call it the patient or the client first, and put their own needs somewhere in the back. The person who is held to what's called a suitability standard is someone who can assess what the particular client has had in experience and understanding of investments and then say, based on their age, their income, their level of sophistication, I think they are appropriate for this investment. And oh, by the way, I get paid to do it. So it just, you have to take a look seriously at how do people get paid and what is their motive for doing what they do. I am what we call in the world of personal finance a fee-only financial advisor. That's a very important distinction because it means that I don't accept commissions from any products that are sold in order to achieve some kind of financial stability. Now, there are people that maybe don't have a certain amount of assets to go to somebody who would be able to sell them some things like some insurance products or some mutual funds where it would be very appropriate for them to pay someone a commission to do this. But generally speaking, people with greater wealth need somebody that is more on their side of the table, who's not looking to sell them something for the sake of getting a commission. That's one way I think people can sort it all out.
I agree. And, I mean, people have the same question in their relationships with their doctors. I mean, most doctors are paid on the basis of their performance. I did an operation and I got paid. If I did more operations, I would get paid more. And I remember one time there were like these hushed whispers in the doctor's dining room, because maybe there was this orthopedic surgeon who was doing operations that were marginally indicated because he had another child going to college. So I think that experience counts, but I also think ethics and integrity really play into.
They do.
You want to have clarity that the person you're choosing truly does put your interests above their own, like you'd trust a doctor to do that. And, you know, finding the right financial advisor, it's tough. And I say this after working with hundreds of financial advisors. I agree with everything that you say. And I just also want to recognize that as consumers trying to build wealth, it gets difficult. It's really hard.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about something that you said to me once, which I absolutely loved. We talked about the dumb doctor deals.
Yeah. So All right. So if doctors don't know whom to trust, will they just turn to financial advice from the people that they do trust, who are their colleagues? So, you know, there was the doctor, there's the surgeon's lounge, and the typical scene, at least back then, was, you know, some doctor would be reading the Wall Street Journal of Medicine and then brag about this investment or that investment that's doing so well. And then another doctor said, ooh, I want in on that one. And the doctor number one would leave. Doctor number two would pick up the phone and call his stockbroker, hey, buy some of this. And so that's a problem because a cardiothoracic surgeon might do a great job replacing heart valves, but that doesn't mean that they necessarily know about how to assess an investment. And so an awful lot of us are like lemmings just jumping off the hill. You know, we trust somebody. We know we can trust them to take good care of patients. So we trust their financial advice. And I would challenge you to identify 10 doctors who've not lost tens of thousands of dollars, if not hundreds of thousands, in dumb doctor deals.
Oh, I could name 10 right now. And that was, I might add, before they came to see me. But I think the point is exactly what you said, that most people who are in the profession would trust other people in their same profession to lead them to things that they think are wonderful opportunities. And in all honesty, I have to say, I also have a client who is a dentist, was a dentist, who got himself involved in some real estate programs early on in his career, and they turned out fabulously well. Now, that's maybe the exception to the rule, but okay, possibilities that there are things out there that are very good, but you have to trust the people and get it vetted by people other than your peers in order to make that make sense.
Yeah, and that's the point. You assess things. You know, I think that there are a lot of physicians who would have no idea what kinds of numbers to look at before deciding to invest in a marijuana farm, which is a dumb doctor deal I did not get involved with, but some of my colleagues did. You know, and that's where you need the expert. Physicians don't have any problem referring their patients to the specialist, yet they don't refer themselves to the specialist who can really assess the situation and help them make good choices.
Mm-hmm. That's for sure. Let's talk about another point you make, which I think is really wonderfully on point in your book. Your financial security impacts every part of your personal and professional life. Let's talk about that for a minute. Can you give me some stories of some situations where someone invested in something and it really flopped totally? How did that affect their performance as a physician?
Well, as you just said, it affects everything. So, you know, how did I start working with financial advisors? Well, I was working with physicians trying to help them achieve their personal and professional goals, sort of reinvent themselves. That was right after managed care, and so many doctors were so unhappy. But as I started talking with doctors, what I realized is that if they were worried about money, if they were worried about how they were going to meet their monthly expenses, then money was running their lives. And it was silly for them to even think about making any changes in their profession before they got on solid financial ground, like especially, you know, something entrepreneurial. Like I was speaking with this person who called me about my coaching services. And he had a solution to weight loss. I mean, this was a systemic solution. He knew that he would not get paid for the insurance company. He'd had some really terrific results with this team approach. And I said, well, that's great. So how much money do you have to invest in this business? And he kind of laughed and he said, you mean, how am I going to pay my mortgage this month? And I told him, you know, it would be malpractice for me to suggest that you make an entrepreneurial risk before you are on solid financial ground. So, I mean, that's one way. We know that there's a lot of doctors who are worried about money, and that distracts them. I mean, it's like distracted doctoring, like distracted driving when you text and drive. If you're worried about money, it permeates every single thing that you do. You know, if you're worried about money and do you need to step in the role of family caregiver and you want to cut back on your work, you don't have the freedom to do that. So money gives you the freedom to have these choices. There's an epidemic of burnout among physicians. Well, if you're on solid financial ground, then you can make some changes in the way that you conduct your practice so that you achieve overall health and joy. You know, not just financial joy, but, you know, you make work a fun place to go. So it pretty much affects everything. When you've got a solid foundation, you don't think about it. But when it's not solid, that's all you think about.
Yeah, I can see that. And I know some physician clients who are like that. They just can't stop spending. And so then they look at it and it just kind of slaps them in the face and says, whoa, how are you going to put money aside for retirement when you can't even pay the bills?
And so that's why I think becoming rich before you become wealthy is important. But here's another thing that I learned in researching this book. You know, we're learning an awful lot about neuroscience, and it appears that we have a biologically hardwired set point that determines whether we're spenders or savers. So spenders are going to be spenders, savers are going to be savers. And I mean, you can modify your behavior, but it takes work and willpower. So if you are a spender, it's difficult. So I was at a medical meeting talking about this particular part of the brain. The next guy who came on the platform was a psychiatrist from Harvard who was talking about burnout. And he was talking about the fact that a stress, chronic stress, impacts that very same part of the brain that's hardwired as the spending, saving set point. And I thought, I wonder how many people are managing stress through spending.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, and I think it's very, very valid point.
And if that is in fact the case, I think we should treat ourselves with compassion as adults and say, okay, I guess this means that I might want to think about some stress management tools, and perhaps I want to make a list of alternatives to spending. And then I came up with even some more startling statistics, which is that there is actually a shopping and gambling addiction. Like up to 1 in 10 Americans has it. And it's kind of like the difference between somebody who enjoys a glass of wine with dinner and an alcoholic. I mean, some people have a perfectly functional relationship with spending, but for some people, the spending's really in control of their lives. And, you know, somebody like that is probably not going to respond real well to just a conversation about other stress management tools. I mean, this goes into the area of an illness that needs appropriate treatment. Gambling is another addiction, kind of like sex addiction. And it is serious and it impacts physicians. I heard about this urology group, and one of the senior partners had racked up hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt with a corporate credit card gambling. And they were scrambling, well, gee, how are we going to deal with this?
Yeah, there's a serious problem. How did they deal with it, do you know?
Yeah, I do. They got this guy into treatment, and all of the doctors agreed to take a lesser amount home so that they could all pay off this guy's debt. So they were responsible. So I remember somebody once telling me, you got to be, if you really want to build wealth, you got to choose your partner as well. And I suppose that partner includes in your personal life and in your professional life.
Exactly. Exactly. Wow. I bet those guys were real happy about that person, right?
Oh, it's hard because what happens when somebody that you really admire and respect, you find out that they have this kind of problem? It's kind of like, you know, a clergy member who you really respect and, you know, you find out that they're abusing children sexually. I mean, it's just not consistent with who you think they are. It's such a disappointment and a letdown and a mess that needs to be cleaned up.
Yeah. And why is it that you think that physicians have such, I don't know what the word is, maybe it's antipathy towards talking about money?
Oh, we're taught to. So really, there are two parts of grooming a doctor. The first part is just giving them the knowledge and tools and skills that they need to take good care of patients. But I think another big part is assuring that this person understands medical ethics and upholds them. You know, what kind of behavior is considered professional, consistent with a physician? And one of the deeply, deeply held ethics is that we should treat patients regardless of their ability to pay. And the best way to uphold that is to just not talk about money. So I think that people of my generation, I'm 58, we were taught not to talk about money. And like, I remember one day when I was just starting my practice, I did a new procedure. I didn't know how much to charge. There was one of my colleagues in the doctor's dining room. And during lunch, I said, by the way, how much do you charge for this procedure? And he just glared at me. And on the way out, he just grabbed me and he said, you can't ask me how much I charge for something. If I answered, I'd be in violation of federal antitrust statutes. You know, we could go to jail for that. Yeah. So,
Where did he get that from?
Well, I believe that he probably was telling the truth. He probably
No kidding.
Yeah.
That's a federal antitrust violation?
Yes. Yes.
Oh my. Well, no wonder you can't ever talk about money.
Right. There was this revolutionary thing that happened. Probably a lot of people didn't catch it, but Medicare's been around for about 50 years. And the amount of money that Medicare pays individual physicians has been a tightly guarded secret. The AMA has made sure of that. Well, with the Affordable Care Act, there's this freedom of information piece, and this information is now public. You can go to a database and find out how many Medicare dollars your doctor collected last year. And of course, what they found is there are outliers, and now these doctors kind of have targets on their back. People are assuming that they billed fraudulently, and you know, there's this whole new thing that you're probably seeing in the papers of doctors charged with and convicted of Medicare fraud.
Absolutely. I was just going to say that's now in the everywhere. There was a whole thing in AARP in their latest bulletin for this month that the front page was all about a physician that charged outrageous amounts of money to Medicare, and he had millions of dollars. He was also smart enough to understand about how to move the money offshore so that nobody could find it. They even found that he had a book that he downloaded from the internet about how to make yourself invisible so that you could disappear.
Wow.
This is amazing. This guy did it all by design. It was amazing.
It is. So there's sociopaths everywhere. And
yes, absolutely. Yes. Yes.
So it's hard because as a patient, then you ask again, whom can you trust? But the reason that you're reading all about this is because of the release of this Medicare data. So now that patients have more financial skin in the game, doctors are developing a different relationship with money. Like Lynn, when I was practicing medicine, you know, I would just like order lab tests. I would, you know, take patients to the operating room. And I had no idea how much anything costs. I can tell you that for one procedure for an appendectomy, the fees that I collected varied from $200 to $1,200, depending on the patient's insurance. So when somebody asked me, how much do things cost? Well, who knew? But, you know, as I look back, I remember being in France, going to a really fancy restaurant, and the waiter handed me a menu without prices. You know, the man got the menu with the prices.
And, oh, yeah. I love that.
Yeah. And I sort of feel like that's what doctors had been doing. They'd been ordering off of this menu, completely clueless about how much things cost. And I think inadvertently, this blindness has undoubtedly contributed to the soaring cost of healthcare.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a great analogy. that you just used about, it's the menu with no prices, because that is exactly the world that you live in. You don't deal with that part of it. You just do the operation. And then how the insurance companies deal with it is a whole other world. So I think to ask that question, how much will it cost, is honestly a question you can't answer.
And physicians are learning the answers. And the reason is that more and more patients have their own out-of-pocket burdens. They need to know how much things cost. So physicians who do cosmetic procedures like plastic surgeons or dermatologists or orthodontists, they are very skilled at talking with people about money and collecting it. Now, here's another startling statistic. You know, doctors send these bills to the insurance companies, and on average, 30% of those claims get rejected, and most doctors don't do anything about it. Can you imagine walking away from 30% of your fee or 30% of your paycheck?
No. Is that because that comes from the doctors, or is that because it comes from poor administration?
Both. You know, doctors are so busy. They're just scrambling on the hamster wheel, just trying to figure out how to get not further behind, not even ahead, but keep from falling behind. And a lot of them think, okay, well, I just need to see more patients. So there's more activity. And because of their lack of business training, you know, they're not really taking a breath, stepping back and saying, okay, how am I going to run a more profitable business? You know, because clearly, if only they collected, you know, 20% more, not even 100%, but just 20% more, they wouldn't have to be in this constant rush to see new patients. If they knew which patients were most profitable or which they enjoyed most and focused on those, and that's something that I help physicians do, that would make a huge difference too. But so another way that physicians, you know, struggle is that we don't get any financial literacy courses. We don't get any business courses. And the only reason that I think about these things in this way, which I know is very basic for anyone who's had a business, is because I ran my own business and I struggled. So I saw that these were questions that needed to be asked.
And how did you get from being concerned as a caregiver and having that program fail, as we just talked about, and then how did you get from that to the decision to go out and educate physicians?
Well, I've sort of approached the marketplace through my spirit as a doctor. So I see a source of pain and I try to alleviate it. So I saw the pain with family caregivers. And, you know, I started a whole company around that, not thinking ahead and thinking, well, gee, how much discretionary income do family caregivers have to spend in this business? And the answer is nothing. That was a stupid mistake, but I was inspired by seeing the pain and responding to it. I've made a lot of mistakes. I've made a lot of mistakes like that. And when it comes right down to it, I think the cause is always the same. It's me not looking out for my own best interests. You know, it's not just, can I serve this other person, but can I serve my own self and my family? I think I probably also walked away from a lot of money by just not asking for my value. You know, sometimes with my financial services professionals with whom I work, I ask them, well, what's the lifetime value of a single physician client? And I think that I, like so many women, just give away our value without asking for financial compensation for it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would say that for many people in my business, especially the few women that there are, I might add, most of us got into this business with a sense of, I want to do this for the better good, because I don't want women to be ignorant of what they need to know about money. But there never was, for many women in this business, a desire for it to create wealth for them, to see it being a business opportunity. It was more a mission. It was more of a something that I wanted to do to make sure that other women didn't suffer in the same way you're talking about this as a caregiver. And I think that's just a follow through of that same concept. We're going to take on the world. Altruism will be the way we do life. And if we make some money and we can pay our bills, then okay, we did well enough. Now, in the meantime, our male counterparts are out there looking at this as a serious business opportunity and determining how much do they need to charge. How much do they need to charge on an hourly basis for the fees they charge, for the financial plans they do, for the assets that they manage, for the insurance policies they sell, blah, blah, blah. It was all down to a specific dollar amount per hour. I never did that. I mean, I just didn't even think of it as being something I needed to do. You know, it's the old story of build it and they will come. Well, I was very fortunate that that happened, but I never set out to do this as a business. I set out to do it as a mission. And right. Oh, by the way, I made a lot of money. But I think that's what you're saying. The difference is women approach most of their professions from an altruistic approach that you wanted to help save somebody for something. And oh, by the way, if I can pay my bills, then I consider myself to be wealthy. But then right. You have the incident in your book of the physicians who are enormously successful, but they're business people.
Right.
They actually were business people.
Right.
And I don't think that most of us see that as being a component of financial success.
Right, right. And I also think that as women, we see it as an either-or proposition. You know, we either serve or make profits. And
yeah.
And what I've figured out in my own personal life is, gee, maybe you can have them both.
Well, there's a novel idea. You think it might happen? Yeah, I think it could. Yeah, well, I think the thing is that really, you mentioned it before, we have no skills that are taught to us in personal finance anywhere in the curriculum. More of that's coming on board today. I'm seeing more and more high school programs designed around money, knowledge and literacy. And I don't see it happening in colleges. I don't see it happening in any of the specialty schools, but I truly believe that it is something that should be taught to students. They need, these are basic life skills. And I wonder how far ahead would they be 10 years into their profession if they knew this stuff when they graduated from their medical schools, dental schools, whatever.
Well, Lynn, I think that it might start much earlier. So I've got a son, he's 18 now, and he is a spender. So I had hired him to help me with one of my boot camps, and I gave him like $200. And he went out and he spent all of it on gifts. For me, actually. Yeah.
Well, isn't that nice?
No, it's not, because I had to sit down and think about the kinds of financial lessons that I had done. I mean, we'd always talked about, okay, here's your allowance and 10% of it goes to charity and 10% of it goes to savings. And then, you know, the rest is for you to decide what to do with it. And clearly he has not gotten that message. But I think that, you know, showing our kids about how money works and how to grow money. You know, I probably have been negligent in not doing enough. But right now, you know, my son writes every time or texts me every time he needs money. And I just said to him, you know, we need to sit down and you need to make a budget and I'll show you how to do that. And I'm kind of beating myself up because why is it that I let him get to 18 without knowing how to make a budget? But I went through my first 40 years without ever making a budget. And I think it starts at home and I think it starts young. And yeah, what do you think about that?
Well, I was going to say, I had the same thing. When I was a kid, you know, especially when we would have, I would call them rite of passage parties. You know, you'd have the birthdays, the Christmas, but then you had graduation parties and you had, I don't know, things like that, whatever it was, even could have been religious events, you know, you were confirmed or something. But there was always a party and people gave you money. And I had the same discipline. that I had to give, my parents told me I had to give half of it to them for savings and I could spend the other half. And that was fine until I got to a point when I was, I think I was 16 when I got my first part-time job, and then it was the same thing. I had to learn to put some part of it away and some part of it I could spend. But I realized very quickly that the amount of money that I was putting aside, that whatever it was for my savings, was not getting me much of any place because they wanted me to put it in a savings account. Well, at that time, they didn't get interest on anything as a savings account. So it kind of lost its luster to me as being a desirable thing to do. And then I think when I got into college and I realized I had a job as well when I was at college, I used that money to help pay for my tuition. That had a different meaning completely.
Yes.
But I think learning about money as being a means to an end was a very valuable exercise because my parents didn't have money to just give me when I said, I need this or I need that. I had to work for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's a totally different perspective on money that I learned than maybe your son did. And I think more than anything, when we are parents, it is harder for us to say no to our children, especially because we know that we make more money than our parents did. And in theory, we probably have more spendable income that we could give to these children, but we do them no favors by doing that. And I don't think enough parents understand that. I think that paying for a portion of your college education is a very invaluable tool. And most parents today, peers that I'm thinking of, they it's almost like a badge of honor that they can say, I paid for my children's college education, so they started out in life having no. Well, maybe that's not such a good thing because they don't understand what that means. So I don't know. You know, I have a very different perspectives on it. It's not such a great thing to graduate from medical college with $200,000 worth of debt either. That's the other extreme. But I do think that if parents look at this and say, paying for a portion of what you really want is a very valuable life lesson, then it's something you take with you as you go through life. But if you've been handed everything, what have you learned?
I was just thinking that when parents don't just give their kids money, they have to have a conversation about it. And yes. I think that that's where we need to start. We need to break through this conspiracy of silence about the taboo of money and just start having more honest conversations.
I agree. Yeah, I really agree that it's time to take this silence of the conspiracy, as you mentioned, off the table, because it does not serve anyone to not talk about money at all.
And that's why I feel so fortunate and privileged to be able to have this conversation with you. I really appreciate your inviting me to your podcast series. This has just been a delightful conversation.
And the same to you. I think it's wonderful that we are on the same path. And I mean that in a really good way, because I think between the two of us and our constituencies and the people that we serve, we can make a big difference in the overall happiness quotient, if you want to call it that, of the people we serve. And the name of your book is
The Myth of the Rich
Doctor. And when will that be out?
Oh, sometime in the next 3 years. I'm actually...
Okay. I think you should get it out now.
Okay. Actually, I've just hired an illustrator and it probably will be out by November.
Well, that's wonderful. It can be a Christmas present.
Absolutely.
Okay. Dr. Vicki Rackner, thank you so much for being a guest on my podcast. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for the invitation. It's been a pleasure.
And it's been a lot of fun to do this, and we'll be listening for the next one.
We hope you've enjoyed your time with us on this episode of the Power of the Purse podcast. If you're ready to take action, go to womenofsubstancellc.com/call and sign up for an exclusive 15-minute one-on-one call with your host, Lynn Evans. Thanks again, and join us next time to explore more ways you can take control of your finances and your life.